the different shrift, the difference between the Fichtean Schelling philosophy, he claims that you can't also say that all philosophy is a series of ways of getting to me. Right? That would be purely Whiggish. But to say that is what he wants to say is philosophy is not the sort of thing in which it would be right to say that whole philosophies are completely false. Same sort of thought going on. So there's a truth content, and he will be, his strategy is to say there's a truth content expressed in a way that leads it to make commitments it cannot sustain internally. So his question is not why is X wrong, but why is X true? That's the first Hegelian question. Simplifies. Okay. Faith. Oh yeah, the truth of faith. So, for example, following this, in pure insight, then says a number of things about faith, like you guys think that when you're looking at a statue, you're looking at God, but look, when you're looking at a statue, you're just looking at a piece of wood. You're not looking at God. Now, the dialectic here is very interesting, and I'll just use this as an example for the whole dialectic of what goes on here at the level of justification as well as the level of action. This is paragraphs 552 through about 556, this analysis. But let's look at that example, 552.3. And the thought here is something like this. Look, on the one hand, faith is not so stupid as to think that when it prays to the cross, or prays to the figure of Christ, or prays to an image of the Lamb, or whatever, that it's not seeing a piece of wood. In that sense, faith has the insight, right, that the meaning of this object is transcendent to its material properties. Now, because, and here's where now it gets pleasantly tricky, but because it simultaneously takes its relationship to essence to be absolute, it doesn't have the wherewithal, that is, it thinks of it as an absolute transcendence, of which it's an immediate relationship, and of which, say, the cross or the statue is the occasion of its putting itself in relationship to the absolute. But because it has no capacity to explicate this, precisely because faith is a self-sufficient notion, then it has no way of resisting, even though it knows the Enlightenment is wrong, it has no way of resisting the Enlightenment critique. Conversely, and it's the converse that's equally important, because in order for the Enlightenment to push through its own criticism of transcendence, it must take the object of belief to be mere wood, and hence loses the capacity for any form of transcendence. And I'm suggesting, I mean, that seems to me, that's what I'm trying to do with Deleuze and Guattari here. I'm saying they get stuck with the mere wood. And it's because they have the notion of history as one of decoding. from the, you know, from the original strange body to its. And this goes on at a variety of levels. And in each case, it's going to have the same kind of dialectical structure. The result is that having deprived itself of all transcendence, pure insight ends up with sense certainty. This is the historical moment where sense certainty arises. Right? This is sense certainty not as an absolute epistemic starting place, but now understood as a perfectly conditioned result of a certain type of skeptical project. This is paragraphs 557-8. And he's quite explicit about this. Just look at 558, just consciousness with its, which in its very first reality is sense certainty and mere meaning, returns here to this form, the whole course of its experience, and is again a knowledge of what is purely negative of itself, or of things of sense, i.e. of things which immediately and indifferently confront its being for self. Here, however, it is not an immediate natural consciousness. On the contrary, it has become such for itself. Whereas at first it was at the mercy of every sort of entanglement into which it was plunged by its unfolding, and now has been led back by pure insight to its first shape, it has experienced that shape as result, being based on the night, so on and so forth. So we both hear, so we double our now reading of sense certainty, in that we both see it in terms of an abstract form of consciousness, which goes through a history of dissolution, and then recover it in its truth moment again now, as an historically conditioned form of consciousness that can affirm itself. Notice, it can affirm itself as the result of a certain history, which then gives it at least the power of reflexivity and drags it out of what I called its original silence. You're looking very worried out here. Someone's doing a sleight of hand, you're thinking, is it Bernstein or Hegel or this whole damn story here? Okay, and this form of consciousness then sanctifies, what's kind of interesting here, is that this form of consciousness sanctifies its own conception of this world as because remember we're in the enlightenment world here, so it wants to say this is not only just, there isn't just sense certainty, but sense certainty here is the good, and of course this is the moment of deism, the clockmaker god, the god who sets a wholly mechanical, wholly material world going and removes himself from it. So deism is simply a religious materialism. And of course it's at this moment that we get the transition to utility, paragraph 560. Such a good paragraph. The deist to God appears in paragraph 559. I know there's always this view that I'm just making this up as a fable about the phenomenology. But Hegel really does say the same things I'm saying, just in a funny way. Both ways of viewing the positive and the negative relations of the finite to the in itself are, however, in fact, equally necessary, and everything is thus as much something in itself as it is for another. So the thought here is that we both have to say that the world simply is this mechanical structure. On the other hand, in order to think of this as a result that we're affirming, we have to think of this structure as nonetheless for us in a certain way. So, you know, the mechanical has the purpose. Or, interestingly, although deism is a mechanistic theory, it does have the thought of man as the highest moment of creation, for which, you know, nature is, as it were, the right, as designed for him to lord over and master and serve his purposes. And this in itself, for another structure, is going to generate just that notion of utility. Everything is at the mercy of everything else. That is, everything is a pure means. Now lets itself be used by others and is for them. And now, so to speak, stands again on its own hind legs, a standoffish towards the other, is for itself, and uses the other in its turn. That is, everything is both end and means. And this is what I want to call, or Hegel is explicitly here saying, utility is a certain kind of theology. That's what makes his account interesting, or a certain rich metaphysics is what he thinks of it as. But we're talking about the theology of utilitarianism. From this we see what is the essence and what is the place of man regarded as a thing that is conscious of this relation, as he immediately is, as a natural consciousness per se. Man is good. As an individual, he is absolute, and all else exists for him. And moreover, since the moments have for him, qua self-conscious animal, the significance of universality, everything exists for his pleasure and delight, and as one who has come from the hand of God, he walks the earth as in a garden planted for him. Now without this, Hegel's saying, you can't even begin to think of man as a part of nature. And if you can't think of a man as a part of nature, then you can't opt for the utilitarian claim of maximizing pleasure. Right? That has no normative force. I mean, it might be a claim about what we do, but you never get the utilitarian thought that we ought to be maximizing happiness and minimizing pain as a part of a naturalistic program. Hence, Voltaire, for example, early and middle Voltaire, was a passionate deist. Right? He was also, you know, a radical naturalist. And that was as, and of course I would say the same about Hume. Okay? Although Hume, I think, is much more interesting, because I think Hume is a kind of pantheist. I'd love to teach the Dialogues of Natural Religion. It's one of the richest text, because, but you must facing, when you read the dialogues, think about this problem. Namely, the problem of what is required for an affirmation of naturalism. So Hume is rejecting certain deistic beliefs, but construing nature in its goodness, is what I want to say is going on in the dialogues. It's a remarkable, remarkable text. Indeed, for those of you teaching rhetoric, it is the perfect text for rhetorical teaching. Because of the different roles, it's a dialogue, and the relationship between the characters and the author and the positions, and the complexity of the issues it's discussing, you know, from arguments for God's existence to the problem of evil. It really is a great, great text. Okay, I'll go on. But what we have here then is a defense of utility as the truth of enlightenment, and significantly, and this is what I'm suggesting, and what you don't get in 19th century utilitarianism, that is in Bentham and Mill, is the way in which, in its original form, slightly there in Bentham, but it really disappears completely in Mill, is that this is a metaphysics of the world. This is not merely an ethico-moral political position. It's that because it's expressive of a naturalistic metaphysic. Now, Hegel, in paragraphs 574 to 81, and I'm just going to get to the transition to freedom, provides an account which seeks to demonstrate that deism and materialism are each subject to critique by the other because each is equally committed to a representational theory of knowledge. That is, each originally, deism and materialism, both take up the idea of pure insight as pure observation. Now, that won't wash. There's an aporia between deism and materialism, which then leads, and this is interesting, to the application of utility to beliefs themselves. In our own time, this is Quine's theory of knowledge. Epistemology naturalized. Or Rorty. Rorty and Quine are both, their evolutionary accounts of epistemology are just this move, applying what is originally ethical notion, namely beliefs are useful in certain ways, solve purposes, blah, blah, blah. So you apply the principle of utility, which is originally a moral notion, to beliefs. And this allows utility to be an account of both knowledge and action, which is fully immanent and, of course, accords with the facts. As a consequence, utility no longer needs deism, but indeed becomes, as it is in the post-Voltairean, and even very late Voltaire, philosophe, a form of passionate humanism. Which is not trapped by the given. You overcome the problem of the given because things are judged with respect to utility. Hence, we don't have that problem of givenness anymore. We have a standpoint of judgment and action that can be driven through. And I think it's very interesting. I would argue that this moment is the ideology of American analytic academic philosophy. This is it. Whole departments. UC San Diego was obviously driven by this account.
What paragraphs did you say this
was? You know, paragraphs 574 to 81. Well, because this is just evolutionary epistemology without making explicit, it's using the idea of utility rather than Darwinian evolutionarism. But our capacity to use Darwin, I would want to say, evolution, in naturalist epistemologies is actually dependent on our relationship to the notion of utility, and not the other way around. That is, I think the gesture towards Darwin is merely a way of claiming Ehrsatz authority for a project whose goodness is wholly internal. And that's, I mean, at least the best thing that can be said about Roy is he's up front. He doesn't gesture towards Darwin or pretend that epistemology is, you know, to be continued. You know, he has at least that pragmatist self-consciousness that allows him to just go forward with this as a reflexive why Rorty is the right way to go, because he applies the principle of utility to itself, or in his case pragmatism to itself. He doesn't claim that pragmatism is absolutely true. He claims pragmatism is pragmatically true, which is why he's so slippery. Now, utility, somebody say this will stop, cannot, after all this, of course, be a mere fact. Utility is clearly more than a fact about how the world works. It's also a kind of ideal, a principle by means of which we ought to order our actions and beliefs. That is, it is both, and this is ambiguous, it's really ambiguous in contemporary philosophy, that is, it's both an explanation about the goodness of beliefs and values, and an account about how we ought to criticize and acquire beliefs and values.
The standard for it?
Yeah. If it don't work, drop it. That's a normative claim. But there's a problem here, especially with respect to action. And it's the classical problem of utilitarian calculus. How do we compare, evaluate, criticize desires? Which desire should we act on? Which desire deserves the claim to be the one that we're going to maximize? Do we act on what is the most intense, or the one that has the greatest stability? How do we relate long-term versus short-term desires? You're sitting here now, you're thinking, well, this might help me get a job. On the other hand, boy, do I need a drink. Okay? Why are you sitting here? Okay? How do you make that evaluation? What's the principle of claim? How do you compare qualitative to quantitative issues? Now, this is obviously a large question. All I'd want to say is the very, I also think it's unanswerable. Because we are reflecting on it, because we must choose which desires to act upon, then in a certain sense, and choose a standard by means of which we evaluate our desires, then in a certain sense we must conceive of ourselves as independent of our desires. In other words, the very fact of choosing, of evaluating, is already showing a kind of self that is transcendent to its desires and prior to them, that has a detachment from its natural ends and is free to order them. So the groundlessness of the nihilistic nephew now reappears in terms of a freedom of choice, or rather the attempt to be self-grounding as an act of freedom.
What is the nihilistic nephew?
Bremer's nephew. Remember we had that problem of groundlessness and self-grounding. And now I'm saying we're getting to utility was a project of an imminent metaphysic. But dodge the question of self-grounding, right? Because it was a metaphysic of immanence. So it was wholly immanent, all right. But located the self in nature, naturalized the story, right? And now I've denaturalized that presumption by saying utility must be normative. Once it's normative, we have the question of how to order, make utilitarian choices, assuming that all rational choice theory is nonsense, which is what I am assuming here. Obviously, it's another course, but it could be like a 10-minute course. Rational choice is so silly. Then we have the thought of we are in a free relationship to our desires, and that's going to generate another problem. But maybe I'll just stop there. Maybe that's a good place to have a break. But all I want to say is there's an intimate connection between, and here's the thesis, there's an intimate connection between a wholly naturalistic story of the early philosoph and strong conceptions of freedom in, say, Rousseau and Kant that we know are directly adjacent to them. And we should not be surprised. And we should not see these as merely two absolutely conflicting perspectives, but see the question of freedom as arising out of the attempt to be reflexive about our naturalistic project in the first instance, and then see what that must amount to. Thus is Clark. Nine. Okay, let's stop. The scientistic paradigm. You just have to let it run and die. Okay, let's try to think about where we are. The thought now is that we have a self that is in a sense shorn of its determinacy. It's shorn of its determinacy precisely because it must conceive of itself as prior to and independent of its desires. And where I take it, one's natural inclinations and desires are precisely what give you determinacy as an individual. But of course, the self that is shorn of its desires and is reflective about what it ought to and what desires it ought to maximize, but presuming itself independent of every desire in making that choice, is simply the reflexive version of the self of pure thought, of pure insight. Hence, its universality occurs through its lack of qualification and determinacy. It is a universalistic self simply because it's identified with its pure capacity to choose, its absolute self-relationship and willing. Hence, the goodness of a system of satisfaction is going to have to be dependent upon willing that system as a reflection of a will that is universal or general. That is, what is worth willing, what is rational to will, must be something affirmable by the will, therefore something not to be imposed on the will. That is, we have to consider whatever we will to be a product of our choice and willing, not a product of desire itself, hence to be expressive of our will. Hence, willing can only be rational insofar as it's self-determining. And that self-determining must be compatible with all others similarly willing, if the thought that such willing, such system satisfactions are not going to be imposed and are to lay claim to a universality, which we've already seen to be criterial for us. So the universality of pure insight now becomes the universality of a reflexive self-determining, and a rational social order is going to be an expression of what I will and what we will, that is, a fusing of the personal and the impersonal standpoints. That is, my willing is rational just insofar as I will what we will, and the we will itself is rational insofar as it is what I would will. That would will, you know, you're hearing forced to be free, right? Are you hearing forced to be free?
I was going to ask you whether we're Rousseau or Kant when we're talking.
Yeah, we're talking about the Rousseauian version here. Because it's a matter of collective self-grounding, a fusing of my will with the will of all, hence an absolute freedom, since neither the whole nor any individual within that whole is being imposed upon. In a little piece by Rousseau, which I think is not translated, I think it's called On Laws, he says, look, we have this choice. Either everyone is independent from everyone else, but then if everyone is independent from everyone else, then somebody is going to be imposed upon, that is, acting on another person's will, right? Now, the question is, how can we avoid, how can we have free willing, which is compatible with the thought that I don't act on the basis of another person's will? Well, it's here that the notion of law comes in. Because law is not my willing or your willing, but obeying something that I can will for myself, and so can each and every other person. So the notion of law is as such posed as what is neutral and joins the individual to the other. The general will, ergo, is simply the thought of lawfulness as what will be the possibility of the fusing of my will with that of the collective. My will and the general will relates pure thought as pure insight, as negativity, to faith as the cognition of essence. That is, general will becomes pure thought, expresses the moment of negativity. The idea of will gives us that negativity, while the principle of the general will gives us the notion of essence. And it's the fusing of the individual and the particular that then makes this look like a realization of the ideal of modernity as a wholly self-grounding, because wholly self-determining, collectivity. Socialization of the self by others is only unconstrained when it is equal to what each self would will for herself. And that is the notion of the general will, as at least... I'm going through all this because Hegel really doesn't go through the transition here. It's one of those funny moments when he just thinks it's obvious to everyone that utility entails the general will. So I hope this explains how the transition has worked. So my thought here is only by the idea of the general will can utility be transformed from a mere desideratum into a concrete reality. And it should not surprise us that there was a sort of mutual understanding of one another by Rousseau and Hume. That they're not that far apart. And of course, Hume was extremely nice to Rousseau. And Rousseau, of course, did what he did to anyone who treated him nicely, and they kicked Hume in the teeth. Rousseau was a thoroughly bad lot. He also happens to be the greatest thinker of the 18th century, by far and away. Now, this final thought is important. Because the general will cannot be simply a criterion of legitimacy. That is, we must read the general will here. And this is how, if there's a sense in which it's correct to see, and there's a whole long debate about this, but if it's correct to see the general will as part of the ideology of the French Revolution, and not merely a criterion for political legitimacy, which arguably is how Rousseau himself intended the general will to be taken. That is, the gap between Rousseau and Kant is actually very, very small. But the way Rousseau was appropriated, and where I'm arguing not altogether mistakenly, was that the general will must really be a will if it is to express the utilitarian metaphysic of immanence, making the world expressive of the self-determining self with respect to desire satisfaction. Hence, actually, rather than, again, as a principle of legitimacy would do, actually uniting particular and universal. So actively realizing the unity of those two elements, which was the suppressed problematic of Greek Zitlakai. Retrospectively, I'm suggesting, we can see more clearly what the specificity of Antigone is. Why there's not a general appropriation of Greek tragedy, but why it's Antigone that has the specificity. Worrying about Liz's worries to me, which I still don't have an answer to, about his references to the Oedipus tales there. But what I'm claiming here is Hegel's relationship to Antigone is that the question of individual and universal must be posed as a question of self and society, and the posing of the question of the relationship between self and society only can be properly posed under conditions of modernity, namely when the self can itself have an identity apart from its social roles or and its particular empirical determinations. And I'm suggesting that the logic of Antigone, I'm going to keep coming back to Antigone, but the logic of Antigone is that the act of the play, right, is the activity of individuating Antigone herself, but now we must read that, which I suggested at the time, but now we must read that notion of individuation in a more radical way, because the notion of individuation here is simply now anticipatory of the thought of an individual who has a reflexive self-relationship in relationship to their society. And when Antigone is drawn out of the family into the polis, right, she loses all determinacy but the one of, retrospectively only now, having chosen to act on the law of the family rather than, right? So the conflict makes retrospectively, the structural conflict retrospectively makes her act one of choice, which it wasn't prospectively. That's the argument. And I'm suggesting that the other kinds of conflict which Greek tragedy run into don't pose that problematic of self and society. Hence, there is something quite specific about the Antigone, and that comes up in this need now for a different relationship between what we mean by the moment of particularity and what we mean by the moment of universality. Now, Hegel is going to unleash in what follows a set of first standard complaints against utilitarianism, namely utilitarianism, for those of you who had the misfortune to read A Theory of Justice will know, leave no room for the individual. That is, the thought is that the criterion of, in its utilitarianism, its classical form, namely maximize the happiness of the greatest number, means that that principle overrides the worth of any particular individual, and that's supposed to be given to us by the kind of classical counterexamples to utilitarianism. Whereby the question is, you know, either you shoot X or we will kill 10. Variations on the Sophie Choice problem. Okay. Individuals don't count. In Britain,